March 21st, this is a new class in the framework of the Shivim Panim, the Scholars Curriculum of the Milton Geshe Program. This is a unit that I think we've never done here in Dallas. I've never taught it, and I think no one else has taught it yet. The beginning of the book of Exodus. There's going to be 10 units. Each class is one unit. Could be that some of you don't have experience with this new type of curriculum that Milton is using. So in these books, they take a unit of biblical text, in this case the first half of Exodus. They divide it into 10 units, and each unit they give you a set of verses about a chapter, and then they give you something between 10 and 14 commentaries from throughout the ages, whether it's commentaries from the Talmudic period, the Midrashic period, whether it's from the medieval period, the modern period, and even postmodern stuff, from all different types of areas within the Jewish world, traditional and non-traditional. They translate them into English if need be. And there's no curriculum in the sense of a certain point they want to bring the student to. There's just a text and all these different commentaries and different subjects, and it's up to the teacher and the students together to choose what to focus on. Again, there's not a specific point they want to teach. There's not a specific message in each class. It's just becoming acquainted with the plethora of commentary from different perspectives on a given biblical unit. Now, it always begins, it should begin, before the commentaries of reading the biblical text, reading the unit, and analyzing it deeply, thinking our own questions, so that when we get to the commentaries, we'll know what things, what matters might be bothering them. We'll be able to better understand the commentaries if we ourselves have begun the process of commentary, of question and answer, of hypothesizing how to understand the text. So, with that very short background, we'll begin. The text is the very beginning of the book of Exodus. It's chapter 1, verses 8 to 22. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at some other biblical verses that serve, in my mind, as background to the beginning of Exodus. And then we'll read the unit itself.
So in the Tanakh or in the...
I'll say, to begin with, we'll open the Tanakh because I want to look at, again, background to the unit that we're going to be studying today. So to make a long story short, a story that everyone knows, in the last third of the book of Bereshit, last third of the book of Genesis, the family of Jacob find themselves in Egypt. There are 70 souls, and they begin to multiply. We know that the second in command of Egypt is one of the sons of Jacob, and that is to say Joseph. He's the minister of economics, or the minister of social services, you might say, perhaps also of agriculture. And during the 7 years of famine, he gives out all the food that he had stored up during the 7 years of plenty and basically saves the country from disaster through his interpretation, as we remember, of Pharaoh's dream. So the whole family, even after the years of plenty and famine have passed, are living in the land of Egypt, and they multiply. And at the end of the book of Genesis, that generation, the generation of Joseph, dies out, he and all his brothers. So I just want to read the verse in chapter 50, verse 26. Chapter 50, verse 26, the very, very end of the book of Bereshit. And it says there, Joseph died, page 84 in the English-only JPS edition, the last verse of the book of Genesis. Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. That's the end of a generation, end of a period, end of an epoch, and the end of the book of Bereshit. And at the beginning of the book of Exodus, we pick up the story. Let's pick up the story in Exodus 1, verses 6 and 7. Exodus 1, verses 6 and 7. What it says there is, Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. So you see that the beginning of Exodus repeats a verse from the end of Genesis. The end of Genesis says Joseph died, and the beginning of Shemot says that Joseph died. And then verse 7, but the Israelites were fertile and prolific. They multiplied and increased very greatly so that the land was filled with them. And that's the background to what we'll be learning today. So, when we go now to begin verse 8, which is the beginning of the unit as defined by our curriculum, 8 to 22, in chapter 1 of Exodus. We can read it from the text of the Tanakh if you want. You could read it from the workbook where it's printed on page 1. It's the exact same text. The workbook has it in English and then in Hebrew on the back of the page. We'll be looking a little bit at the Hebrew, a tiny bit, but mostly at the English. So I'm going to read now chapter 1 of Shemot 8 to 22. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Yosef. And he said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them so that they might not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the ground." So they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built garrison cities for Paro, Pitom, and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they increased and spread out, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians ruthlessly imposed upon the Israelites the various labors that they made them perform. Ruthlessly they made life bitter for them with harsh labor at mortar and bricks and with all sorts of tasks in the field. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra and the other Puah, saying, "When you deliver the Hebrew women, look at the birth stool. If it is a boy, kill him. If it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, fearing God, did not do as the king of Egypt had told them. They let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing, letting the boys live?" The midwives said to Paro, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous. Before the midwife can come to them, they have given birth." And God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and increased greatly. And because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Then Paro charged all his people, saying, "Every boy that is born you shall throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." Now, in examining the text we just read, I want to do it on two levels, the macro and the micro. The macro, I mean certain basic questions and understanding the whole tenor of the passage as a unit. And by the micro, I mean individual matters, little words, little phrases that might not be clear or might be open to two or three meanings. And I want to begin with the macro, the big picture of this whole portion. So I'm going to ask the following question. And it turns out to be a little bit harder than you might think, the answer to this question. The question is as follows. What is the ultimate purpose of the king of Egypt? What does he want to accomplish? Through everything, through this whole paragraph from beginning to end, I can be more, I can divide it into two. What's bothering him? What's the problem? And then what's the solution? What's the goal? What's the purpose?
We're the problem.
Okay, we're the problem. Great. That's a good answer.
Rabbi Shlosian, is Zev going to be here?
That's next.
Oh, screw it up. I'll see you later.
No, she's well,
Stephanie's not in this class, according to my list.
Oh, I thought Jim was. I saw him on the email.
I don't see Jim on this list either. So, the problem is us, and Myra's right, but we have to define it further. What about us is the problem?
There's too many
of us, right? That's clear.
Right.
So what's the goal of Paro? What is he trying to do?
Make less of us.
Make less of us, right? Again, that seems pretty simple.
Yeah.
The goal is to have less Jews. Okay, so if the goal is to have less Jews, then we have to understand how the measures that Paro takes are supposed to make less Jews. Let's go back and look. The first thing he does is verse 11, to oppress them with forced labor. So how is forced labor supposed to make less Jews?
They work too hard and they die.
Okay, one possibility is they work too hard and they die.
They're too tired to procreate.
They're too tired to procreate. Yeah. Okay? Or they're too... Now, we can also add to this, they work so hard that they die, or they're too hard to... They're too tired to procreate. We can also add, not just tired physically, but also tired emotionally.
Sure.
We find often in times of war, people don't want to procreate. There's no point in having children, you say, if life is so bleak. What's important here to notice, and the truth is, I'm not sure that I noticed this until I started preparing this unit, even though I've been reading these verses for how many decades, I'm not sure if I ever noticed that Paro's goal is not slave labor. That's only a means. Right? He doesn't need slaves. According to what we just said, and what we said is the absolute pshat, the purpose of what he does is not for the economic benefit, it's not for the output of the slaves, that's just a means to get rid of these Jews. To me, that's an insight that's important to take note of. All the material is right there on the table. Okay, let's say we've gotten as far as we just did, and I think it's all true. I have another question, and I'm going to ask the question in two different fashions. It's the same question, okay? The question is, if that's the goal of Paro, why didn't he immediately do what he ultimately did in verse 22? We're on page 1 and 2 in the booklets.
Trial and error.
Trial and error. First of all, everyone sees what we have in verse 22? What does it say in verse 22?
Every boy is throwing
them. Throw them into the sea. Right? Into the Nile. So if his purpose of less Jews, the best way to accomplish it is to throw some of the Jews into the sea.
He may not have wanted to kill everybody first. He just that would scare them.
Okay, so he didn't want to kill them at first. Why not?
He probably felt he could control them.
Is that right? Yeah.
But why is controlling them better than throwing them into the sea? I mean, he ultimately wants to have less of them, so make less of them. Make it easy.
He valued life somewhat.
Okay, so that's a very good possibility. It could be that Paro was not a totally immoral, ruthless killer. And he hoped that he could get rid of some of the Jews without directly killing them. And therefore, he began with the slave labor, and only when it didn't work did he feel he had no choice. No choice! What can I do? I don't want to kill them, but I have no choice. There's just too many of them. And then again, he doesn't kill all of them, just the males. By the way, why just the males? Why not the females also? I would think the opposite. If you want less Jews, you should have less wombs. Apparently, it's not just that he was afraid of too many Jews. It was afraid of too many soldiers,
yes,
right? Too many
right.
able-bodied men who might revolt. Right, so we're really here figuring out what was on his mind. His mind was that he's afraid that these Jews are going to rise up against him, and that's exactly what we find in verse 10. Right? In the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us. So his fear was too many able-bodied Jews who might rise against him. The solution is to have less of them, but he's not willing to just out and out kill them. He wants to do something more humane to begin with. So he just enslaves them with the hope, like we said, that they'll procreate less, whether for physical reasons or for emotional reasons. So, Eileen said something very nice, right, that Paro was not a totally ruthless and immoral character. Perhaps he had some moral backbone, and that's why he didn't want to kill them if he didn't have to. But there's also another possibility. It's not that he was so much afraid of killing them for moral reasons, but perhaps something else. And that brings us to verse 10. Verse 10. Let us deal shrewdly with them. What does shrewdly mean in this context? Why does he have to say, just let's deal shrewdly with them? Why doesn't he just say, let's make slaves of them? What is this? What's shrewd about it? What is his methodology here? It's a hard question.
He knew the Jews were smart.
smartly. But smartly, for what reason? Why? What's the methodology of his smarts here? That's a hard question, because if I explain it too well, I'll give it away. I mean one thing: secrecy. Secrecy. What it means, apparently, let us deal shrewdly with them, is that he doesn't want anyone to know about his fear of them revolting. Let us deal shrewdly, in other words, let's decrease their numbers without anyone realizing what we're really doing. That might be an alternative understanding to what Eileen said. Eileen said perhaps he doesn't begin by throwing the males into the sea because he has some moral backbone. That could be. But another reason could be because they're afraid of public opinion. And therefore, let's do it shrewdly. And we'll find ways to decrease their numbers without anyone realizing what our plan really is and what we're trying to do. In the end, it doesn't work. And therefore, he's forced to stop dealing shrewdly and to do it openly. Notice I'm saying that shrewdly here really means in secrecy. But in the end, it doesn't work. And he has to command the people, the Egyptian people, to throw the males into the sea, which means the people are going to know what's going on. But Paro hopes they'll cooperate. So I think those are the meta issues here. Number one, his goal. And number two, his methodology of secrecy. And with those big issues having been discussed for a few minutes, we can now go to the micro and go through the verses and ask some smaller, more localized questions. Okay? We're good. Okay, so we're going back and reading verse by verse. Chapter 1 of the book of Exodus, verse 8, and again in the workbook that everyone has open, it's page 1. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Yosef. We have to ask ourselves what that means. What does it mean? Didn't know Yosef. In what sense did he not know Yosef? Literally never heard of the guy? And if he had heard of the guy, if he did know Yosef, why would that make a difference? Okay, all Jews aren't bad. Can someone continue that line of reasoning, or a different line of reasoning? Okay, gratitude would indicate that you don't do such terrible things to the Israelites because Yosef saved your country. But this Paro doesn't have any gratitude, doesn't have any respect, doesn't have any recognition. He doesn't know Yosef, apparently, in the sense that he doesn't give him any credit. It could mean that they literally never heard of the guy, and therefore doesn't give him any credit, or he heard of the guy, he knows of him in a historical sense, but he doesn't know of him in the sense of appreciating him. There's no gratitude here. So the verse therefore begins, the unit begins by saying that there's a lack of gratitude here in the behavior of the Egyptians. Now this new king, there probably have been one or more kings since Joseph died. But a new king, what could it mean, a new king? Not just a new person on the throne. Could it mean something more than that?
King and Pharaoh are used interchangeably, aren't they?
Yes, a new Paro, but not just a new Paro. Because again, there probably were one or two or three new paros already since Joseph dies. In what sense a new king? Could you think of anything that would help to explain how he didn't know Joseph, didn't appreciate Joseph?
Joseph preceded him.
Joseph preceded him, okay, but there's history books and again, there's family tradition.
Came from someplace else. So.
Ah, right, that's a possibility. It could be a different dynasty. That is, usually the kings, the paros ruled, within their family, the father, and then the son, and then the grandson, etc. A new king might be a new kingdom, a new dynasty, a new family. And then it would start to make sense, because a new dynasty wants to purposely wipe out and erase the memory of the previous dynasty. And it could purposely be not knowing Yosef. right? Purposely erasing the memory of that earlier dynasty that had to use the services of a foreigner, of a Semite, of an Israelite. So a new kingdom arises, and they want nothing to do, perhaps, with the previous rulers and their ways and their customs and their history. It could be, it's a possibility. And he said to his people in verse 9, "Look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them." And we said that probably means let us deal with them, but secretly. Let us make less of their numerous numbers, but secretly, so no one knows what they're doing, so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they'll join our enemies in fighting, and that's the matter of the males we talked about earlier, and rise from the ground. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire, what does that mean? Let's look at the Hebrew. The English translation purposely left it vague, as it is in the Hebrew. So the Hebrew, you can see both on my sheet, where I write in C1, that the Hebrew is Va'ala min ha'aretz, rise from the ground. But you could also look at the Hebrew in the context, because if we turn from page 1 to 2 of our workbook, we have on page 2 the full Hebrew text, and the place we're looking is in verse Yud, the third verse. Do you see where I am? Let me show you here where my finger is. Right? So the verse is a rather long verse, and the last three words of the verse, the last three words, are Ve'ala min ha'aretz. The word Ve'ala is the last word of a line over here, and then the two words on a line by itself are min ha'aretz. Ve'ala min ha'aretz. So to put it all in context, and I'm going to go back to the Hebrew, let us deal shrewdly with them so that they not increase, otherwise in the event of war they'll join our enemies fighting against us. Ve'ala min ha'aretz. Literally, and go up from the ground, or grow up from the earth, or grow up from the land. So one question is, what is the subject of the verb? Allah min ha'aretz, go up from the ground. Two possibilities of the subject, just without even knowing anything in Hebrew or in English, what are the two possible subjects given our context? Who could it be that goes up? Okay, let me ask it differently. Let me ask it differently.
I said weeds.
I understand. Right. So then I have to ask it differently. Let's begin with my second question first. My second question is, Va'ala min ha'aretz, go up from the ground, grow up from the land, grow up from the country. What does it mean? So let's ask what the verb means before we ask what the subject is. Now, it probably means leave the country. Go up from the land, Allah. You know, to leave Egypt. Egypt, remember, is lowlands. We're talking about the population being concentrated in the Nile Delta. To go up means to leave, just like to go to Aliyah, to go up with Israel, means to go into it because it's high, where Egypt is low. So to go up from it means to leave it. So if the phrase means go up from the land, leave the land, then the question is, who's leaving? Who's the subject of the verb leaving?
The Jews.
The Jews. And if Fanny is right, so what does the verse mean? The Paro says, let us deal shrewdly with them, so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join their enemies in fighting against us and leave the land. Does that make sense?
Well, if they... No.
It doesn't make... Why doesn't it make sense?
Because if they're fighting and they win, they're going to stay in the land that they won.
Yeah. And also, we said Paro's whole problem was too many Jews. Yeah. So why would he be afraid if they leave the land? That would be great.
Right.
So another possibility is that the subject of the verb is not the Israelites, but rather...
The Egyptians.
try that out for size. Right? Read the verse. Let us deal shrewdly with them, so that they might not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us, and we'll have to leave the land. We, meaning Paro and his people, will have to leave the land because the Jews will have increased. They'll join our enemies in fighting against us, and Allah min ha'aretz will be forced to leave the land.
I don't read it that way at all.
It's certainly...
He was really afraid of them.
Slaves are below. The picture that you have in mind of a master and slave is a master over a slave. If the slave's going to rise up, it's clear, just a figure of speech. Rise up from the ground. Because that's where they are. They're working on the ground.
However, they're not slaves yet in this verse. And in verse 10, they're not slaves yet. Good morning.
Good morning.
Right?
I think.
Sure.
They're not slaves yet. They are regular citizens. But you know what? Even though they're not slaves yet, perhaps Howard is right. Perhaps we could read the verse in a fashion I never thought of before, that Paro's saying, lest they arise to a higher status. Not in the sense of leave the land, but in the sense of just Allah min ha'aretz, rise from the ground, and they become perhaps our leaders. And therefore, perhaps our enslavers. Perhaps that's Paro's fear. That's a good point. I didn't think of that. So therefore, we really have three different ways of reading the verse. Either what Fanny said, that the fear is that the Israelites will leave, but that's again hard to understand. Or the way I suggested, the fear is that the Egyptians will have to leave. What Howard said, the fear is that the Israelites will arise to a higher status and they'll become rulers and subjugators. Yeah,
that makes more sense.
That's pretty good. Yeah. I must say, that's pretty good. I'm actually going to make a note of that. Israelites rise to subjugate us. Okay, so let's go on. And then we get to verse 11. So they set taskmasters over them, and we're understanding, and based on the macro we developed, that the taskmasters for the forced labor are in order not for the slave labor, but in order to discourage procreation. To oppress them with forced labor, and they build garrison cities for Paro, Pitom, and Ramses. Okay, so I want to look at the Hebrew now in verse 11. So let's turn to page 2. And look at verse 11, which is Yud Aleph. And we're going to read verse Yud Aleph, the fourth verse, very slowly. And I'm going to also make a note to myself. And it says, V'yasimu alav sarei misim, which means then they put upon it, on the Jewish people, sarei misim, leaders of forced labor. How does the English put it? English says, taskmasters over them. Lema'an anoto. Lema'an means in order to oppress them. And I think personally that the English translation missed something by saying, so they set taskmasters over them to oppress them, and leaving out in order. Because if you have the in order there, you understand that the purpose is not to get the labor out of them. The purpose is to oppress them. That's not a means. It's the goal. You hear what I'm saying? The purpose is to oppress them. And we said, what type of oppression are we talking about? Oppression that discourages marital intimacy. Because the whole matter is to prevent procreation. It's not in order to build the cities for their own sake. It's not for the economy. It's all to prevent there from being too many Jewish boys. And the Hebrew, again, really makes that clear by saying, lema'an anoto, in order to oppress them with forced labor. So now listen to this, guys. It's now only 2 weeks before the Seder. And we've already began here a unit in Exodus dealing with the slavery in Egypt, and I thought it would be a great thing if we could to connect our learning right here to the Seder. And there is a very important connection. So, before we open up the Haggadot, I want to go back to what we just read in Hebrew. In verse Yud Aleph, the fourth verse, we said, Leman Anoto. Do you see in Hebrew those words? I want everyone to see them. Leman Anoto. In verse 11, verse Yud Aleph, read it again. V'yashimu alav sarei misim lema'an anoto. In order to oppress them. Now I'm going to write those words on the board. In order to oppress them. Lema'an anoto. And that word to oppress them is our important word. That word, oppress, it's to oppress it, meaning the Jewish people, that appears throughout the book of Exodus and throughout the Haggadah, meaning to oppress. By the way, does anyone remember that we call matzah the bread of affliction? Mm-hmm. It's the same word in Hebrew, lechem oni, the bread of affliction. It's the same word. Oni is anoto, a red on the board. We call matzah lechem oni, the bread of oppression. It's the same root. Ayin, nun, and then having a yud or a vav or a second letter. I won't explain how it works in Hebrew, but there are three letter root. Ayin, nun, and then the last letter, here it's a yud, here it's a taf. It's the same. It's the same thing. The full root, if you want to talk in grammatical terms, the root is ayin, nun, hey. In this form, the hay falls out and you have a tuff in place. In this form, the hay falls out and you have a yud in place. It's the same root, the bread of affliction. So now, just think of this. This is so exciting to understand what's going on here. And I really, I never really put all these things together until I was preparing this unit. So the bread of affliction. We understand now the affliction, the oppression was for its own sake, right? It's not because Pharaoh wants the slaves to build buildings. It's not for the economy. It's for the purpose of afflicting them so that there's less Jews. Which means so that there's less marital intimacy, right? And all that's the pshat. We've seen that again and again, right? So now I want to show you something just beautiful. We're going to open up to the book of Deuteronomy chapter 26. Deuteronomy 26. And in Deuteronomy chapter 26, it's on page 314 in the English only edition. Deuteronomy 314. We find here a passage that summarizes the whole Jewish experience in Egypt from slavery to freedom. Deuteronomy 26, verse 5 to verse 8. And I'm going to start reading in the middle of verse 5. The middle of verse 5. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there. But there he became a great and very populous nation. 26:5c. I said the very end, the middle or the end of verse 5. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there. But there he became a great and very populous nation. So he went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there, but there he became a great and very populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. That's our word we're looking for, oppressed us. Everyone have the Hebrew? You can read it to me. Can I just read everyone the Hebrew? I'm sorry. I meant to say the next verse. The next verse is our important verse.
B-A-B-6.
We cry to the Lord, the God of our fathers. The Lord heard our plea and saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. That word oppression is onyenu. The same root again. Onyenu. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put it on the board. Onyenu. Our oppression. So the Lord heard our plea and our plight, our misery and our oppression. The Lord freed us from Egypt by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm, an awesome power, and by signs and portents. So the word appears again and again and again, that same root, to describe our oppression in Egypt. And again, we understand now that it's not the physical oppression it's talking about. It's about the effort to stem procreation. And we saw that's the pshat of the verses in the first chapter of the book of Exodus. So now, listen to this. Everyone knows, or should know, if you've heard me speak about this last year, the year before, the year before, the year before, the year before, or perhaps you don't know, that at the Seder, as mandated by the Haggadah, when we tell the story to our children of the slavery and freedom, we don't read from the beginning of Exodus, but we actually use the verses in Deuteronomy 26 as the foundation for the Haggadah. The Haggadah is built on Deuteronomy 26, and we expound upon the verses. The verses we just read, from verse 5, 6, 7, and 8. That's the foundation of the Exodus story in the Haggadah. And now I want to open up the Haggadah and read what it says about that one phrase in Deuteronomy, Onyenu, our oppression. You ready? So we're going to open up in the Haggadah to page 16, with thanks to Rabbi Maxwell House. By the way, I don't drink coffee, but I appreciate a good Haggadah. Page 16. Look at the very middle of 16, where you have a four-line paragraph in English. And we cried out to the Eternal, the God of our fathers, and the Eternal heard our voice, saw our affliction, our sorrow, and our oppression. In this translation, the words our oppression...
Affliction.
Say it again?
Affliction.
Right, we're looking for our affliction. Here it's translated as affliction. When it says our affliction, in Hebrew that is onyenu. And the word onyenu is the first word of the third line in Hebrew. Onyenu. Mm-hmm. That's the word on the board. Here it's translated as affliction. So, after the Haggadah brings that whole verse, we read the whole verse, right? Then the Haggadah goes and breaks the verse down, word by word, and explains each word of that verse. So let's go down to the bottom of the page in English, where it says, and he saw our affliction. That's three lines from the bottom. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. What that is the Haggadah is now copying that piece of the verse that was brought up here in order to explain it. And what is the explanation? What's the explanation of saw our affliction?
Separation from the way.
And now you guys understand where the Haggadah got it from. Isn't that beautiful? You probably read this for 30 years. How did the Haggadah say that affliction means separation from wives? What's the connection? What's going on here? But the answer is that we've just learned for the past hour, almost the past hour, 40 minutes, mm-hmm. We start at 9 o'clock, we've just learned that in Exodus 1, right,
now you know.
The whole purpose of everything Paro did was to prevent procreation. And when it said that he puts them into slavery, leman anoto, in order to oppress them, it meant in order to prevent marital intimacy. That's the pshat. And therefore, when the Haggadah explains that same word, inui, in Deuteronomy 26, the simple meaning of it is exactly what it says. Separation from our wives. That's really what it means. It's not a midrash. It's not off the wall. It's not crazy. It's exactly the pshat of the verses. I'm fascinated.
He was such a bad
boy. Right?
Because the general, I imagine you're that way, because the general definition of affliction would be a physical beating or something else, not what you've done.
But here, the whole purpose of what Paro did is not in order to get out of them slave labor. It's rather to prevent procreation. That's what the verses say.
Is this a means of genocide without...
I've been waiting for 40 minutes for someone to say that. Because as we read these verses, we more and more understand the parallels to Hitler's Germany. And let me tell you that the first time I learned these verses at the beginning of Exodus, it was with my sainted teacher, Nachama Leibowitz, who was born in Germany in the 1920s and escaped right before Hitler closed the gates. And when we learned these verses in her class, I was in my 20s then, she made the point so clearly, and we could also do it ourselves right here. After we go through this unit, we see the different stages involved. It began, remember, secretly. Mm-hmm. And only at the very end does Paro do it openly. And it goes stage by stage, such that, at least in the words of my teacher, Nachama Leibowitz, one of the purposes of the secrecy in the stage by stage, so that the Jews at no point feel that it's too much. They get used to it. And it's not certain what's going on. Perhaps this is going on. We're not clear. You can fool yourself. Until at the end, it's too late. You've been duped into staying. So let's go continue reading through the verses. Back to our verses at the beginning of Exodus. We're now in chapter 1, as we were, in verse 12. But the more they were oppressed, the more they increased and spread out. Because it didn't work. And there are fantastic descriptions in the Midrash, by the way, of why it didn't work. And we won't go into that now. We don't want to stray too far from the curriculum here. But the whole purpose of the oppression was to prevent marital intimacy. For some reason it didn't work. They kept spreading out and increasing, so the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. That's verse 12. And now we get to verse 13. The Israelites ruthlessly imposed upon the Israelites the various labors that they made them perform. That is a stepping up, a ratcheting up of the affliction. And I think the point is now that they made life bitter for the Israelites, not in order to get more economic output out of them. No, but because the purpose was to prevent procreation by not leaving them any energy physically or any desire emotionally for intimacy. It could even be that the economic output of the slaves decreased as you made life harder for them, but the purpose wasn't the economic output, as we've shown. Ruthlessly they made life bitter for them with harsh labor at mortar and bricks with all sorts of tasks in the field. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. One of them was named Shifra and the other Puah. So here we get to something fascinating. It says the Hebrew midwives. We want to look at the phrase in Hebrew. I brought it on my sheet in F. And of course we also have it in the Hebrew text on page 2. Let's look at page 2 at the Hebrew text. And it says here in verse Tetvav, which is verse 15, where my finger is, V'yomer melech Mitzrayim l'mialadot ha'ivriot. Mialadot ivriot is the Hebrew midwife. I'm going to put that on the board. Examine that for 2 or 3 minutes.
It's not erasing so well.
Le mi ya le dot ha iv ri ot. So let's begin. We all know, by the way, I promise you, you all know these two words. Because the word ivriot, ha ivriot, we all know what that means. Ivri, Hebrew, right? Ayin bet resh is the root. Ivri, which means Hebrew. They were Hebrews. I'm sorry, they're Hebrew. Ivri. Now, what's the first word?
Lemi yaladot, the root is yud, lamid, dalid. Yud, lamid, dalid.
Yelid.
Yelid, child. Mi yalid means to make a child. Or to cause a child to be born. In other words, midwife. Mi yaledet is a midwife. Mi yaladot is the plural, midwives. So Paro said to the midwives, the Hebrews, Hebrew midwives. The word Hebrew is modifying the word midwife. He said to the Hebrew midwives, fine. But now we have a very interesting and fascinating grammatical question. Hebrew midwife, does that indicate the personal identity of the person?
Or
the job of the person?
Why would he have talked to Hebrew midwives if they were Hebrew? They would have immediately told all the people that they were delivering, or would have told the whole community. I cannot believe that they were Hebrews.
That's a very good point. It's very possible it means the Egyptian midwives who served only the Hebrews. So we have to keep in mind these two possibilities, and we'll see in the commentators. Now, Miriam already led us down the path of asking ourselves, so what does it matter if we read it as midwives who are Hebrew or Egyptian midwives who serve the Hebrews? What does it matter? Well, she brought up a very good point, that if it's Hebrew midwives, well, then they would have to be dupes for Paro, right? They would have to really be betraying their people to do what's happening here. But to be commanded to do what they were commanded. But if they're Egyptian women, then we understand why Paro could have asked them to do what he asked them to do. But if we say they were Egyptians, then we have to re-examine their refusal in the end. Right? In the end, when they refuse, let's read the verses. So I'm going to read on in verse 16, 17, 18. Saying, when you deliver the Hebrew women, look at the birth stool. If it is a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live. And Paro, like Miriam says, can say that to these women because he says they're on my side. They're Egyptians. Very possible. The midwives, fearing God, did not do as the king of Egypt had told them. They let the boys live.
They're Jewish.
No. So either they're Jewish or...
they have conscience.
They have a conscience.
And they do their job. The job means to deliver, not to kill.
Right, they took the Socratic, the Hippocratic oath.
Yeah, right.
Right? So they have a conscience. And by the way, the phrase, fearing God, doesn't mean in the Bible, first of all, it doesn't mean anything necessarily we would call religious. And it doesn't mean fear as opposed to love. To fear God means to have a conscience. Let me just show you one example that I can show you of 10. I brought the example here. It says, look in Bereshit 20:11. Bereshit 20:11. So we'll go back to our Tanakhim, to the story of Abraham, the patriarch Abraham, to Bereshit chapter 20. Verse 11. And what happened here is Abraham goes to what today is called Gaza, to King Avimelech there, because there's a famine in the land. I'm sorry, not because there's a famine. And he tells everyone, this beautiful woman I have with me, this woman, is my sister. And Avimelech takes her as if she's an eligible woman, and wants, of course, wants her to join his harem. And then God punishes Avimelech, and Avimelech finds out that this woman is really married to Abraham, and Avimelech says to Abraham, why did you lie to me? Why did you say that she is your sister? Why didn't you tell me that she's married to you? And Abraham's answer in verse 11 is, I thought, said Abraham, surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. What it means is what Miriam said. I thought these people have no moral code. And therefore, I had a lie to save my skin. Without going through the whole thing, the point is that Yirat Elokim, fear of God, simply means a moral conscience. The Bible believes that moral conscience has to be founded upon a belief in a higher being. But that's a different story.
Don't we figure out later that Pharaoh's own daughter thought it wasn't a very good idea when she took Moses?
Ooh, I was hoping that we'd connect things back to that class we had about 5 or 6 weeks ago. So if we say indeed that these midwives are Egyptian, and here we see that they fear God and they don't follow the command of Paro, but they do the right thing. So we see another example. I think we mentioned this when we talk about the daughter of Paro. Another example of Egyptian women who end up helping the cause of the Israelites with a certain degree of perhaps identification, with not just with morality, but with this poor, beleaguered people.
Well, they also really risk their lives because they're conscientious objectors in the most profound way.
Absolutely.
If Pharaoh found out what they did.
Absolutely. Very good point. Okay, so let's just finish off the verses a little bit further. Verse 18. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing, letting the boys live?" The midwives said to Paro, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous. Before the midwife can come to them, they've given birth." Okay, I'm going to ask a question about that verse 19. So let's say that the midwives are telling the truth. Of course they're not, but let's say they're telling the truth. And before the midwife gets there, the child's already born. Okay, so the midwife gets there 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later. Why can't the midwife kill the boy then? Why is this an excuse? Why does Paro hear the midwife say, "We get there 2 minutes late, we couldn't kill the child"? Why not kill it 2 minutes later? What's going on?
Well, he doesn't want the Jews to know that that's what they're doing.
It's hidden. It's exactly the point. Very good. Which means that what was the original plan?
The baby was born dead.
Right. The original plan was to give the impression of a stillborn. Now we understand the whole secrecy thing. Right? And the midwife gets there 5 minutes late when the mother's already heard the baby crying. It's too late. And that's why Paro buys their excuse. Because he really didn't want them to kill the babies in an open fashion. And then, only after Paro has no choice but to reveal his secret plan, does he finally say in the last verse, "Okay, kill the kids openly. I have no choice. My hands are tied. I tried my best to do this in secret. It just didn't work. I'll have to take my chances," Paro says. But of course, at this point, we could say that the Egyptians have already gotten used to the idea of persecuting the Jews. And it's not so bad, from Paro's perspective, to do this openly, because he's already accustomed his people to the moral compromises that are involved here. And again, the memories of Hitler's Germany are the exact same thing. By the time Hitler actually began to kill Jews openly, the German people were already used to it. And it wasn't so bad anymore. It was just one step further from what had been done already. So, let's now just concentrate on the last three verses, and then we'll go on to the commentators. Verse 20. "And God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and increased greatly. And because the midwives feared God, he established households for them." So the big question is, what is going on here? What do you mean he established households for them? What does that mean?
Conversion.
They were rewarded. They had places to have families so that they could increase and multiply.
They themselves.
Right.
Okay, mm-hmm. That could very well be. It could be that since the midwives feared God, so God established households for them, let them increase, let them have children. Brad Bruce said it's a matter of conversion households within Judaism, which is really fascinating, certainly could be. I want to reveal to you that the Hebrew is much more ambiguous than the English. We have to look now at verse 21 in the Hebrew. So it's the second to last verse at the bottom of this page. Chaf Aleph, right? My finger is on Chaf Aleph. If anyone needs me to show you where it is, the second to last verse at the bottom of page 2. And it says, Vayehi ki yaru hamiyaladot et ha'elohim, translation, and it was that feared the midwives God, and it was, since the midwives feared God, v'ya'as lehem batim, and he made for them houses. Now the point I want to make in looking at the Hebrew is there's no subject. The verb ya'as, the third to last word on the line, and he made, it doesn't require a subject. In Hebrew you don't write he, you just write the verb. Now in English when they translated it, they wrote he and they capitalized it. Why did they capitalize the H? Because they assumed that the subject is
God.
But that's very plausible, but it's not certain. Perhaps there's a different subject. So let's go to the English and try and figure out who the other subject could be. Right, the top of the page. The English says, and God, 21, and he because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Now, it could very well be that God is the subject, because God was the subject in the previous verse, right? It was all about God. But of course, verse 19 talked about Paro. Could you think of the possibility that in verse 21, the he refers to Paro?
No.
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 Why would he give them anything?
Why would he reward them?
Who says it's a reward? Can you think of it being a punishment?
Is it a bribe?
Household?
The Hebrew is batim, houses. He made for them houses. The English translation assumes it means households and progeny, but if it's just houses, what could it be?
A prison.
A prison, right. It could be a prison.
Wow.
It could mean that, and because the midwives feared God, Paro put them in prison.
Or he separated them.
Separated them from the populace?
Isolated them.
Isolated them. Or it could mean that Paro established birthing centers. Not prisons, but birthing centers. Which means that the women giving birth would always be under scrutiny. Think of the possibilities here.
But establishing a birthing center could also be a killing center.
Which is what it was supposed to become. Right. Very good. Right? In other words, under the guise of medicine, under the guise of helping the poor indigent population, help me out?
Indigent
population, you actually end up with gas chambers.
I think in this line, though, if we say that it was Paro that did this, that it was maybe separated them out more like a prison, because the next line says, then Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every boy born. I mean, it's like he charged everybody there.
Right.
Time they saw a baby, just throw them a boy.
I would agree that you're probably right. Because if verse 21 was another way of killing the babies, then verse 22 would be kind of unnecessary. So then we're saying 21 is only a punishment, but still, Paro has a problem. What is he going to do with this increasing population? So he has to tell his whole people, every boy that is born, you shall throw into the Nile. By the way, there's one little point that I forgot to mention 10 minutes ago. As we've been talking about the secrecy here, and that's why the midwives, if they get there 5 minutes late, can't kill the baby, because the mother already realized that the baby was born alive and not stillborn. That also is an explanation. The secrecy is an explanation of why Paro didn't tell the midwives to kill all the children, but just the males. Because if it was all the children, then people would realize something is going on here, because not all children are born stillborn. But if it's only half the population, then people might not notice. Right. Just let me write that down. Yeah.
But that leads to only one conclusion, that everybody's stupid. Even in very primitive times, they knew what the survival rate of you know, there was a very poor survival rate.
Right.
Most children died in childbirth.
Or within the first year.
And the wives died in childbirth, too. So...
You're saying stupid that they couldn't they notice it's only boys that are dying and not girls.
That's very obvious if only girls survive.
I'll tell you what my teacher Nachama Leibowitz would have said. She would have said, it's amazing how stupid we can make ourselves in order not to realize that we're being oppressed and killed. Mm-hmm. We want to make everything look good. And as long as some children are surviving,
it's okay.
We can assume that it's all a natural matter and there's no plot here against us. What can I say? It's possible.
Considering her life, yes.
Yep. So, we just scratched the surface in a very, very important fashion. And the whole essence of the Milton curriculum is now to take a small number of the 13 commentaries they prepared for us with beautiful English translations and see how these commentaries deal with or answer or grapple with some of the issues that we ourselves have brought up. So I chose, of the 13 commentaries, I chose to deal only with those commentaries that they brought us that focus on the issue of the midwives. And we'll finish within 2 hours, I hope. So, as I wrote on the back of the sheet I gave out, we want to look at commentaries 1, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. So, commentary 9 that they brought for us is on page 11. And this is from the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. And let's just do a small part of it, because time, as usual, is short. Okay, we'll do all of it, but quickly. And the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, etc. That's a quote from our verse. And what does the Talmud say about it? Rav and Shmuel differ in their interpretation. Rav and Shmuel live... in the first generation of Babylonian Amoraim, which means about the year 250. One said they were mother and daughter, and the other said they were daughter-in-law and mother-in-law. According to him who declared they were mother and daughter, they were Yochevet and Miriam. In other words, the mother of Moshe and the sister of Moshe. That's mother and daughter. According to him who declared they were daughter-in-law and mother-in-law, they were Yocheved and Elisheva. Elisheva is the wife of Aaron, Aaron being a son of Yocheved. So either it's Yocheved and her daughter, Miriam, or Yocheved and her daughter-in-law, Elisheva. What's important for us in reading this Talmudic commentary is we see here an answer to a question we had asked 20 minutes ago. The question was, what's the meaning of the phrase Hamiyaladota Ivriot, the Hebrew midwives? Does it mean midwives who are Hebrew or midwives who serve the Hebrews? And the Babylonian Talmud, what does it say? What's the answer according to the Babylonian Talmud?
They were Jewish.
Which is against what Miriam said. That's perhaps why Miriam went out. She didn't want to read a commentary that's against her approach, right? So she left the room. Fine. Let's read the next Talmudic line at the top of page 12. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. Rav and Shmuel differ in their interpretation. One said that they are the priestly and Levitical houses. In other words, house in the sense of dynasties. Because if the midwives were Yochevet and Miriam, well, Yocheved, of course, gave birth to Moses and Aaron. And Aaron is the priestly Levitical houses. So, what came forth from that line are the priestly Levitical houses. And the other said they're the royal houses. In other words, the house of King David from the tribe of Yehuda, because Elisheva, the daughter-in-law of Yocheved, she married into the tribe of Yehuda, of Judah, which eventually gave birth to the house of kings, King David. So according to the Talmud, the midwives are Hebrew, and the verse that says that he made for them houses, it's God who's the subject, and it's a reward, and it means he made for them progeny that became famous and central in the Jewish people. That was their reward. But there's other approaches, as we know. Now, where are we now going to find the approach that Miriam likes? The approach that says that the midwives were not Hebrew. They were rather Egyptian. We're going to find this in Josephus Flavius, the Jewish Roman historian of the first century. In his book, The Antiquities of the Jews, he describes all of Jewish history, including the biblical period, and he includes many, many midrashim in his description of how to understand the Bible. Now, Josephus wasn't a scholar, he wasn't a rabbi, he's just repeating in his book what he learned in Hebrew school. And if he writes in his book, as we're about to see, that the midwives were not Jewish but rather Egyptian, that means he got it from somewhere. He didn't create it. He doesn't create midrash. He's not a rabbi, he's not a scholar. So he probably learned it in Hebrew school. So let's see. This is in the last paragraph of Josephus. We're on page 13 in our workbook. And let's start reading from the last four lines. Line 31. Line 30. He commanded that they should cast every male child which was born to the Israelites into the river and destroy it. That besides this, the Egyptian midwives should watch the labors of the Hebrew women, etc. So what did you say? The Egyptian midwives. Now this is especially fascinating to me because as far as I know, we don't have any surviving midrashim that say that the midwives were Egyptian. Midrashim we don't have. But if Josephus says that, there must have been midrashim that he learned in Hebrew school. Perhaps his Hebrew school teacher told him that and it wasn't recorded. But we see that there was such an approach already 2,000 years ago. So the Talmud brings one approach that they're Jewish, and Josephus reflects a different approach that they were not Jewish. Okay. Let's read now Commentary 11, which is Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. And if you take the N of his first name and the T of his second name and the Yud of his third name and the B of his fourth name, you get Netziv. That is acronym. And by the way, his son changed his last name from Berlin to Bar Ilan, and Bar Ilan University is named after the family of the Netziv. This is the very end of the 19th century in Russia, the Netziv.
They do that? Why do we have all of these, you know, the Ramban and the Ramban and the Ralbach?
It's an easy fashion to remember them. Do you want to say every time, Rep? Now, Tali, Tzvi, Yehuda, Berlin, the Netziv. It's easier. I don't have a different answer.
Right. We do that. I mean, somebody has a name to call him Chick.
You wouldn't call the rabbi, you know.
Also remember that in ancient times, the less ink and the less parchment, the better. When books were written on parchment with a quill pen by a scribe, every effort was made to save space and to save ink. And even when the printing press was invented, paper was still expensive and printing was still expensive. They still made every effort to conserve. This is one example of that. Anyway, the Netziv writes in his commentary on the Torah, he established houses for them. That is our catchphrase from the verse, right? And we remember that we don't know who the subject of the verb is. It's not clear in the Hebrew. The context would indicate that it's God, but it perhaps isn't. The verse does not specify who did this to allow for two interpretations. The Netziv really has a very interesting approach here, that the verse wants to open itself up to two different interpretations, one that it was God and one that it was Paro. It could be God, in which case the houses are the reward. As Rashi says, and as we saw in the Talmud, it could be the king. In other words, it could also be Paro who made the houses, in which case the houses are to prepare for the next stage of the decrees. Let's go on. Every boy that is born, when he tells the Egyptian people to throw the kids into the sea, how will they know? When he made houses for the midwives, he assigned them guards to escort them to all the births. Then the guards will be able to see what is born. So just think of this. That means the midwives are under house arrest. And every time they get a call, they're allowed to go. But they have a minder that goes with them. And the minder takes a census. Either he kills the baby himself, or he just makes a note and arranges that the baby be killed later. So it's not exactly prison to punish them. It's rather a system of surveillance to know where they're going and what they're doing. And you wonder, the Netziv is living in Tsarist Russia right before the beginning of the communist era. You wonder if he's not foreseeing the future, right, of communism. Wow. So we probably only have a few minutes left.
History repeats itself.
History repeats itself, absolutely.
Nobody knows.
In the Milton Scholars curriculum, when they bring us all these fascinating commentators, many translated into English for the first time, they bring the commentators chronologically, from the earliest to the later. And at the end, in other words, when you get up to commentator 10, 11, 12, they always bring modern, postmodern commentators, which I find fascinating. They're the commentators that I have the least contact with from my traditional Jewish education. And here we come in 12 and 13 to two postmodern feminist academic commentators who are both fascinating. And we won't have time to read both, probably, but let's read the first one, Commentary 12, Tikva Freimer-Kensky, who, it says here, teaches at the University of Chicago Divinity School. The midwives made an independent moral decision. Fearing God, they refuse to obey immoral orders and do not murder the boy children. Called on the carpet, they do not declare their defiance in what would have been both a futile and fatal act of frontal resistance. Instead, they trick Paro, belittling the Israelite women as animals who give birth so quickly that they need no midwives. The word chayot, animals, is too often softened in translation to lively. Let's see what she's talking about. The word lively that she uses in our translation was what? Does anyone know which word she's referring to?
I don't know, vigorous.
Vigorous, vigorous. And the word in Hebrew is chayot. Chayot. Now, the root is chai, alive. And that's where the English translations get lively or vigorous. And of course, what the midwives are telling Paro is that they're too healthy, right? They're too strong. The babies just shoot out of the womb before we can even get there. Makes perfect sense. But this particular post-modern commentator, Tikva Freimer-Kensky, is pointing out that the word chayot could be, as we translated, chai, in the feminine plural, you know, they're lively, but the word also means animal. Chayot are animals. Beasts of the field, chayot, from the same root as live creatures. And she's saying that has a double meaning. That at the same time that the midwives are saying to Paro, they're vigorous and the babies just shoot out, they're also implying they're vigorous like animals. And it's a put down. They're not human. Humans have labor that requires a midwife. Animals, it just happens naturally. And she's claiming that we miss that connotation in the English translation, because we just see the word vigorous or lively. We don't understand that the midwives are also subtly belittling in front of Paro the Hebrew women. Of course, which would
say that the midwives were Egyptian.
Thank you very much. Right? That makes a lot of sense.
But they're making it up.
They're making it up because they want... Why are they making it up? Why are they belittling the...
So that it looks as if they were unfair.
Because they have a moral...
Right, right. So they're cunning.
God, yeah.
They're actually using and manipulating Paro.
Okay, so the insinuation is that Pharaoh doesn't remember how good the Jews were in, say, Egypt and everything, but could it be the midwives? You know, stories have been passed down through generations, and they remember how good the Jews were.
Uh-huh. Right, maybe. So they have a certain allegiance to Joseph and what he did for the country. That's a very good point.
That's why I think the last part of Josephus is just cynical. It is he was wrong in the last five lines of Josephus. That besides this.
So what exactly is saying that he was wrong about?
I'm saying that his interpretation. You're saying that he was just a. All he was doing was repeating what he had heard at Cheda.
Right.
He heard the wrong thing. Whoa.
But he's the one that said they're Egyptian midwives, and that's what we're working with now.
On the assumption that they are.
So what is wrong about what he's saying, Bruce? I'm not.
I just think it's a cynical. I think what he's saying in this last.
You're back in Josephus. You're in the Netziv. I'm sorry. You're in Tikva. Primer Kinsky, I'm not...
No. I'm in commentary 10.
Uh-huh. So he said that the Egyptian midwives...
That besides this, the Egyptian midwives should watch. Should.
That's what Paro said to them. Yeah. Watch the labors.
Yeah.
And observe. Yeah.
All right.
I don't see the problem there. So going back to Tikva Primer Kinsky on page 14, I'm reading where I left off. The word chayot, animals, is too often softened in translation to lively. But the midwives would certainly not compliment the Hebrews over the Egyptian women. Instead, building on the fact that Paro sees Israel as other, they make an ethnic slur belittling these others. Right? That's what we've been talking about. In this way, they demonstrate to Paro that they're not in favor of the Hebrews, like Miriam said. Right? They're trying to get on his better side. And to disguise the fact that they're really working as secret agents for the Hebrews. Not seeing the power of these women to defy him, Paro is all too willing to hear something negative about Hebrews and falls for their trick. He's duped and he doesn't see that they are duping him. The midwives have failed to kill the male children and have pulled the wool over Paro's eyes in a way that shows his own denigration of Israel is ludicrous. The humor in their answer to Paro is compounded by God's response. God rewards them for their uprightness by making them very successful.
That.
More successful midwives means that fewer children die at birth, and as a result, Israel grows even more numerous. But she's referring to the verse that had said, God dealt well with the midwives, verse 20, and the people multiplied and increased greatly. Their reward was that there are more and more children born. It's a natural type of reward. Well, I guess we should end here. I'd recommend to look at the last feminist commentary 13, pages 15 and 16, that we're not going to get to. And, of course, look at all the commentaries that we had to skip. And try and come at 9:00.
Yeah. Sorry, we really missed it.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. This is really kind of far fetched, but didn't Hippocrates predate these guys? Could the Hippocratic Oath been somewhere in there, and these midwives have known about it? Or
well, actually, I don't think this predates the Hippocratic Oath. The Hippocratic Oath probably goes back to not more than 400 years before the Common Era, and we're about 1,200 years before the Common Era. But still, you could say they are the precursors of the the behavior brought forth in Hippocratic Oath. Okay. So I'm going to just record who